And you're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My name is Pokey Anderson, and I'm welcoming our second guest today to Sunday Monitor, Betsy Leander Wright. Welcome, Betsy.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Pokey.
Thanks for being with us. Betsy is an economic justice activist who was out playing in the snow this morning in her Boston area home. She is the communications director at United for a Fair Economy, which is a national nonpartisan nonprofit group. And its website is www.faireconomy.org. They raise awareness that concentrated wealth and power undermine the economy, corrupt democracy, deepen the racial divide, and tear communities apart. Betsy co-authored a book in 1999 called Shifting Fortunes, The Perils of the Growing American Wealth Gap. And her new book, coming out in the spring of this year, is called Class Matters, Cross-Class Alliance Building for Middle-Class Activists. So let's start out with, let's just take a minute and talk about the ownership economy. That was a phrase used in the inaugural address. And parse that out for us, if you would, Betsy.
Well, this is a phrase that, in the form of ownership society and, yes, sometimes ownership economy, that President Bush has been saying for the last few months as an agenda for the second term and an ideal for the United States. And on the surface, it sounds pretty good. It sounds quite similar, actually, to what we say at United for a Fair Economy, that we should be broadening how many people own assets. And we're in an economy here where asset ownership is very concentrated at the top, and most people have basically nothing. And there's kinds of assets that just make you a lot more economically secure, like a retirement account, a home ownership, a little nest egg to weather hard times. And we actually believe that that should be spread around, that we should be taxing wealth at the top in order to broaden wealth for people that don't have any right now. So you would think, oh, ownership society, President Bush is singing our tune. But turns out that the kinds of things we mean, like first-time home buyer programs, building a lot of affordable housing, and then helping with low-cost mortgages for first-time homeowners to buy it, you know, that would be what we would mean by it. That's not mostly what the president means. He mostly means if we privatize Social Security, then on paper anyway, everyone will have ownership of this little private account. He also means things like take charge of your own health care as opposed to having it sharing the risk across millions of people through a national health care system or even through state-level systems or big employer systems. So these actually seem like steps that would make us more economically insecure instead of less, which is not the point from our point of view.
Would you review for us the number, 5% versus 95% of wealth? I always forget how to say it. But
the top 1% right now owns about 38% of the wealth, which is more of the wealth than is owned by about the bottom half.
Okay.
So that's a way to say it. And that's very historically high. It was a little higher before the 2001 crash. It hit 40%. This is very different than the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, where there wasn't such an enormous concentration of wealth in the top 1%.
And then those numbers that have changed over the last few decades of a CEO salary versus the working person's salary.
That's right. Right now, it's 300 to 1 that the average CEO of a big company earns 301 times as much as a non-supervisory production worker, average across the country. And that's compared to 40 to 1 in 1980, and it was also 40 to 1 in 1960. So, and it's way bigger gap than any other industrialized country has, although some of them are moving a little in our direction. So we think 300 to 1 is just obscene. That's as if the value of a company is primarily the one guy at the top, and that as if the products and the positive things that the company creates are not created by all the employees of the company.
Well, actually, one of the things I investigated Enron and worked on a book on that, and one of the things we found in the last full year of Enron's existence before they went bankrupt was that not only were the CEOs and top executives making a lot of money, they didn't even let any of it trickle down to the stockholders. They took 80% of the purported profit and put it in their own pockets. So yeah, it was unbelievable.
That's really horrible. And there's been a lot of those stories where a company's going bankrupt and they've cut off the you know, they've unfunded the retirement pensions and, you know, done many other things, done massive layoffs with no severance pay. And yet somehow the golden parachutes of the executives are always protected. So we definitely feel like there's not a spirit in this country of shared sacrifice, that if people at the bottom are being asked to take a sacrifice, that the people at the top should be the first and to go and should take the biggest sacrifice, actually.
Well, actually, Smedley Butler was a wonderful Marine of the early part of the 1900s. He said that the way to stop war, he called it, war was a racket, he said, and wrote a book about it.
Yeah.
He said the way to stop war would be make sure that nobody made a profit on any of the war materials and war contracts. And he said it'd be over in a few weeks.
It would be over in a few weeks. I think that's very applicable right now where, you know, this is the first time in our country's history that we had tax cuts during wartime. And, of course, we had tax cuts targeted at the wealthiest people. The predominant share of the Bush tax cuts went to the top 5% and heavily in the top 1%, and very little for regular working people. And meanwhile, you know, there's people risking their lives who they're saying, oh, you can't have your disability benefits if you can't have your veterans benefits and your disability benefits both at the same time. There just seems like this incredible callousness towards people whose actual lives are at stake.
People who actually live the rhetoric of patriotism are, you know, making $1,200 or $1,400 a month.
That's right.
To do that. Talk a little bit about the piece that United for a Fair Economy has just put out, partly pegging it to Martin Luther King, called State of the Dream, and some of the things that have been going on since the year 2000.
Yeah, what we looked at was, we looked at the progress of people of color and white people, you know, the breakdown by race of asset ownership, income, poverty, unemployment, and we found this disturbing pattern that for people of color, the 90s were steady improvement, slower than we all would have wanted, but unemployment steadily fell for Latino people, black people, Asian people, and for white people as well, but it fell faster for people of color so that the gap actually narrowed, and similarly, income rose, poverty fell, and assets rose. And so things were, the race gap was slightly closing during that boom time of the 90s after 1992. And then in 2000, all those trends reversed. And if you look at our report, which is on the website at faireconomy.org, you can download the whole report. Each one of the line graphs, they have this shape where it just turns, the direction turns after 2000. So unemployment, of course, we had a big recession in 2001. Unemployment rose for all races. But then it stayed really high for African Americans. It's been over 10% almost every month. It just went down to 9.9 once, but it's basically been over 10% since 2000. We've been out of this recession now for, what, let's see, from November 2001, and now we're into 2005. So it's been heading towards 3.5 years of recovery, of economic growth, and yet the black unemployment rate is not falling. And similarly, poverty has gotten worse. The income for black families are down $2,000 of median income since 2000. Black income finally broke the $30,000 barrier for the first time in 2000, and now it's down $2,000, less than that. Everybody, every race has lost money, but since 2000, for white families, it's about $1,000 down, and for people of color, it's fallen more. So this economic recovery has not been a recovery for everyone, and I think that we're not making progress towards Martin Luther King's dream, and we're not making progress towards anything that could plausibly be called the ownership society when people, it's hard to even keep a job or have your income be more than your expenses.
Well, one of the things that Dr. King talked about later in his life was poverty, not civil rights, just right. Civil rights, but poverty and that income and wealth gap. And a lot of times people don't really remember that.
Yeah, and I think he was speaking for all poor people and not just black poor people. And we start the report with the quote, "Let us be dissatisfied until those who live on the outskirts of hope are brought into the metropolis of daily security." It's, you know, he just had this moral vision that in such a rich country, this is just plain unacceptable to have people languishing in poverty. So I think that we're we still evoke that every January 15th, and yet I don't see political leadership, at least at the federal level, that's taking action that would live up to those words.
Let's look at home ownership for a sec. A lot of people, I mean, I'm white, I was raised middle class, and like many people that I know, when I went to buy a home, I got help from my parents.
Right.
And in your report, it says about half of white people do get help from their parents in buying a home, but only one-fifth of black people get the same help. So it's like generation after generation, some of these, you know, it's the, okay, how do you pull yourself up by the bootstrap if your parents don't have a bootstrap?
That's right. Exactly. That was taken from this wonderful new book called The Hidden Costs of Being African American by Thomas Shapiro. Just came out in 2004. And he actually interviewed black and white families at identical income levels about their finances in detail. And it's a fascinating book.
Tell the name again.
The Hidden Costs of Being African American.
Okay.
And because, of course, now we do have not so many barriers. It's more people of color getting into professions and into well-paying trades, which is wonderful. And so there are some people with more what you think of as a decent income or even a really high income, and that's great. But what he found is that at the same level of income, the difference in amount of assets is really varies by race, and that assets have a lot to do with what happened in prior generations, both in the positive sense. That, of course, you can have inheritances, and that's a lot more common for white people, even not just rich white people. You think of inheritances, you think of, you know, a multi-million dollar estate or something, but just a modest amount, the average white amount of inheritance is $21,000, according to the Federal Reserve, but the average black inheritance is $2,000. And for Latino people, it's a little under $400. So, you know, the $21,000 isn't a big fortune, but it sure is different than $2,000 or $400 when you're thinking, could you make a down payment on a house? Could you send a kid to college? That the fact that the prior generations were able to get ahead enough to have assets makes all the difference in what you can do with your whatever level of income. So I think that's what we've got to say is we're not just trying to get everybody access to decent incomes in this generation. We're trying to overcome generations of inequality by getting everybody in the door to having some assets.
So President Bush's idea of ending the inheritance tax, how does that play into this idea of equality and lessening the wealth gap?
Right. So there are some conservative black multimillionaires who would say something very much like what I just said and say, therefore, we have to get rid of the estate tax because we've got the first generation of black millionaires and they should be able to pass something on.
Hmm. How many of those are there?
There are a few. It was Robert Johnson who started the BET, Black Entertainment Television, who took out an ad in the New York Times with some other black multimillionaires. Now, But of course, at United for a Fair Economy, we have led the charge to protect the federal estate tax. So we would disagree with that argument because of exactly what you're saying. How many are there? The federal estate tax, if you project out the next 20 years, you know, it's, I don't know if your listeners all know this very absurd and complex situation that one of the Bush tax cuts repealed it for 1 year and then restored it to an earlier year before it had been modified. So it's very bizarre. But say they made the repeal of the estate tax permanent.
Mm-hmm.
The 20-year loss to the federal revenue would be $1 trillion. $1 trillion, because there's so much money being passed down right now of the post-World War II generation, or the World War II generation, who became very prosperous and are now starting to die. There's so much wealth being passed down right now that if that goes untaxed, then it's going to be this huge hole in the revenue stream, which there's only two ways to make that up. One is more taxes on the rest of us. The other two is massive budget cuts, which is going to entail, since there aren't that many discretionary things, cutting out the things that are the ladder of opportunity, such as college scholarships, affordable housing and first-time home buyer programs, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, health expenses. So either way, it's going to be a bigger burden on working people. When you talk about spreading the tax burden around, there aren't many less painful places to put it than dead multimillionaires.
Yeah, people over a million or two are the ones who get taxed on inheritance.
That's right.
Betsy,
there's an exemption of a couple $1 million.
Wait, this time has gone really fast. We'll have to have you back when your book is out. I can't wait.
Oh, good.
And we'll
we'll
talk about that. Class Matters, cross-class alliance building for middle-class activists.
And it's already excerpted on the web at www.classmatters.org.
Great. Okay, I've been talking with Betsy Leander Wright about some economic issues, and she's with United for Fair Economy. You can find that at the web, faireconomy.org. And you've been listening to Sunday Monitor. Before that, you heard Sibel Edmonds interviewed by Mark Babawi. And I'd like to thank, of course, our engineer, Byron Jackson. Thanks to Susan Lanfesti for her piece about the inauguration. And thanks to Ann Reed for reading it. And if you have any tips or comments on the show, you can write to us at Sunday Monitor at journalist.com.